Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Rethreaded offers hope and a fresh start to survivors of human trafficking right here in Jacksonville. None of us should be defined by the worst things that happen to us. Learn more about how you can unlock the potential of survivors at Rethreaded.com. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist at Mayo Clinic and professor of healthcare science at Arizona State University. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, what does AI in healthcare look like for you and me as patients? NextGen's healthcare's chief medical officer joins us. But first, today's episode is not your typical medical show. We're going to take a closer look at a condition that afflicts millions of women worldwide, endometriosis. Joining us are two incredible guests who will shed light on this complex condition from both medical and personal perspectives. We're covering this condition because it often doesn't get the coverage it deserves, afflicting 2 to 10% of American women between the ages of 25 and 40, causing symptoms like painful menstruation, amongst many other symptoms. Joining us, first we'll have Dr. Chandra Adams. She's a local OBGYN physician, an expert physician affiliated at HCA Memorial Hospital, and an expert in gynecology and endometriosis. She's going to provide us with insights into the latest advancements in understanding and treating the condition, which is basically a situation where tissue like the lining of the uterus grows outside of it, causing pain and other symptoms. In addition to Dr. Adams, we're honored to also have Ms. Tam Carter. She is going to bravely share her journey living with endometriosis. Tam will give us a firsthand account of the challenges, triumphs, and everyday realities of navigating life with this often misunderstood condition. Both of them are joining us now in studio. Dr. Adams, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tam Carter, welcome as well.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with you, Dr. Adams, because I think listeners will be out there and they just won't know. They hear a big medical word that makes us all sound smart when we use it and have no clue what it is. But a lot of people have this. So what exactly is endometriosis and how does it affect the body?
So endometriosis, the introduction that you gave is actually exactly what it is. I like to refer to it as the inside-out disease. So the uterus, you know, women are very complex.
Yes.
In many different ways, but physically especially. So we have a muscle layer of the uterus, and then we have tissue that's on the inside that has a purpose of building up to create a nice, soft, fluffy home in case a baby wants to implant there. And then it sheds once a month if that doesn't happen. And that tissue is supposed to be on the inside of the uterus, but for women who have endometriosis, the inside ends up on the outside. And that tissue grows on any organ, really, on which it can implant. So it can be on the shiny surfaces that line the area of the pelvis called the peritoneum. It can be on the bowel. It can be on the bladder. It can really even travel to other areas of the body. There are case reports of women who've had endometriosis implants even in their lungs.
Wow.
And so when they have their menstrual cycle, they cough up blood because that lining is hormonally active. And the same way that it is supposed to shed from the inside of the uterus, it sheds in other parts of the body too. So if you've ever gotten blood on a t-shirt, like I'm thinking about a detergent commercial where they show you that blood gets on a shirt, it makes it really sticky and hard and things kind of stick together. That's the same thing that these microbleeds that occur outside in the pelvis and in the abdomen, it causes the organs that are supposed to just slide past each other very easily, it causes them to get stuck together. And it gets really gooey and sticky in there. And when you look in at surgery, it's like someone just poured Elmer's glue in someone's pelvis, and everything that's supposed to be sliding past each other is just really stuck together. And you can imagine that's a condition of extraordinary pain.
Wow, there's so many questions. Let me follow up. So do we know why? Because it almost sounds like, in one level, when I hear cells outside the body implanting, that almost sounds like cancer, but this is not cancer.
You are correct. So we have some theories. We don't exactly know why, but there some of the theories are that perhaps some of this tissue is shed by blood, that there are vessels that connect and supply the uterus and the uterine tissue, that perhaps some of the endometrial tissue breaks off and travels through the blood to other tissues. There's also a theory that, you know, when we're all created and made, we have tissues that turn that have the potential to turn into any other type of tissue. And so perhaps there are some implants, some microscopic implants that were just kind of waiting for puberty to develop and to create these kinds of tissues in places that are actually supposed to be turning into other types of tissues. And then there are theories about surgeries. So cesarean deliveries, where you open up the uterus and expose the endometrium and then sew it back together. You can't sew it back exactly perfectly. So do you then seed some of the endometrial tissue out into the pelvis? And then there's a theory about retrograde flow. We know that the tissue is supposed to flow forward or downward, rather, vaginally to exit the body. But in women with endometriosis, sometimes we see if the uterus is tilted backward, then perhaps they get retrograde flow out through the tubes and get microscopic implants of those tissues.
Wow. You talk about how the tissues can be stuck together and it causes pain. Is that the most common? Is that the main symptom? What are the symptoms?
So it's such a chameleon of a disease in terms of its presentation, but the hallmark examples are painful cycles. So these women have pain that's so extraordinary, it stops them from going to school, stops them from going to work. They're doubled over. They have nausea. They're just completely incapacitated and totally debilitated for several days. Then you have some patients who have pain that radiates down their thigh, and that may be something that's not readily obvious. Then you have some who have just painful intercourse, and then some who have pain with certain movements like exercise or just anything where you would expect your organs to be able to move and not have pain. And then if the endometriosis implants grow large enough, like there are cysts on the ovaries, endometriomas, that can grow 10, 12 centimeters and cause pelvic heaviness sensations. So it can present in a number of different ways. Some women get blood in their urine. Some women get blood in their stool. So you can see endometriosis present in a myriad of ways.
So what's the diagnosis? Is this a scan or how do you make that diagnosis in women?
So a high index of clinical suspicion is always the first thing. So when someone comes to me with debilitatingly painful periods, it is endometriosis until I can prove that it's not. And the only real diagnosis is to see it. So laparoscopy, a minimally invasive surgery where we can actually take a look around inside the pelvis and the abdomen, can be both diagnostic and therapeutic, because if you see those endometriosis lesions, you can excise them from the tissue and a lot of times reduce a lot of the pain and then lyse the adhesions or take down some of the things that are stuck together inside the pelvis. And usually you'll send a biopsy of the peritoneum or whatever tissue on which you identified it to the pathologist, and they identify it as endometrial tissue.
Wow. So if going in and, you know, making sure that you see it is the diagnosis, What happens in treatment? What does treatment look like for this?
So because this is a chronic condition that persists with its symptoms until menopause, it is chronic management of symptoms. So for some patients, that looks like recurrent surgeries. Every couple of years, they have to have a laparoscopy to excise new adhesions. Ultimately, some patients end up with hysterectomies to just remove the source of the endometrial implants. For other patients, it's just pain management, chronic pain management. And whether that looks like pain medication or holistic measures like acupuncture or massage therapy or hydrotherapy is frequently helpful to some of these patients. But it really just depends on what her constellation of symptoms are.
Is there any alternative to surgery, or is that that's what has to be done if it's that severe?
Well, if it's that severe, yes. I do have some patients who have very mild endometriosis, and I will also say that the degree of severity isn't always concordant with the surgical findings. I had patients who were absolutely, you know, incapacitated, and you go in for surgery and you see one little spot of endometriosis behind the uterus. You take that spot out and she gets a new lease on life. And then there's the other patient who has maybe just a little bit of aching and is just wondering whether it could be endometriosis. Maybe she's had some trouble getting pregnant. And you go in and you see, well, yes, because her tubes are you know, swollen shut, as everything stuck together with endometriosis, but she barely had any discomfort. So again, it really just depends on how severe the symptoms are for the long-term treatment.
I imagine, and when you're talking about surgeries and things of that sort, that there's an impact here for fertility, which could get impacted if one goes down that pathway for management.
Yes, absolutely. So the most common way that endometriosis does affect fertility is that scar tissue. So scarring the fallopian tubes shut, not allowing the passage or the ability for the egg to be fertilized and or to implant. And then also the heavy painful periods and the discomfort with intercourse. So if women are uncomfortable, they're just not even able to conceive because they can't even imagine enjoying intercourse enough to conceive.
Are there any other medical or health complications that arises if you don't get this treated?
Typically that comes from the adhesive disease. As I mentioned, it can implant on the bowel, and so you can end up with bowel obstruction. And as you know, I'm sure, the consequences of bowel obstruction, you can end up with sepsis and peritonitis, systemic infection if you have an obstructed bowel due to endometriosis adhesions.
To all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. We're going to take a brief break and we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're exploring endometriosis, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tag me on X at @JServin. We're now going to add the voice of a patient who has had this condition. Tam, I want to, first of all, thank you for kind of coming in studio to talk about your experience, but can you share your journey, your personal journey of being diagnosed? How did it all come about?
Thank you, Dr. Adams. You described it beautifully, but as you say, it's not beautiful at all. I just started having really bad, painful cramps around my menses when I was probably 19, 20. And it got so bad, I couldn't go to classes, I couldn't go to work. So I found myself strapped to the bed for the probably the first 3 days of my cycle, until I just got tired of it. And I consulted with my doctor at the time, and which just was over 20 years ago. And I consulted with him, and I told him, I said, I'm losing money from going to work. And I am having to constantly retake courses because I'm getting behind. So when I'm not in pain, I'm constantly catching up. So he didn't change words. He actually did a laparoscopy and found I had stage four.
Okay. What happened after that?
Within a year, I had abdominal surgery. Where it looks almost like a cesarean, and I was in the hospital for about 3 days. He showed me pictures of it all. At this time, I was in my early 20s. A lot of it I didn't comprehend. I didn't understand. I didn't realize the backlash it would cause later on. But I healed from that. Within 2, 3, 4 years, I started feeling pain again, and I went back into the same cycle of things, but I did not have another surgery at that point. I didn't have another surgery probably until 10 years later, mm-hmm. And at that point, it was really because of fertility.
How are you doing now?
I have good days and bad days now. Perimenopause has kind of stepped into place, actually. So, but I still have good days and bad days. It is hard to keep a pattern because it affects work. Everyone endometriosis symptoms don't affect them the same. For me, it's debilitating where I can't do anything but stay home or on the heating pad, or sometimes I take medications that will subside it for momentarily, but it's nothing that will long term.
Got it. It's a constant battle.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a constant battle.
How's it affected your life as a result?
It has affected me all parts of my life, of course. I used to monitor how I would do things, like my schedule. Certain times of the month, I couldn't travel, or I couldn't plan to do this, or if it's a social event, I didn't plan to attend. So I just kind of mimicked my life around my cycle. And it has affected personal goals, where I might haven't finished them at the time frame that I might have wanted to. I finally got my 4-year degree in 2019. That was a huge accomplishment for me, because when I was in that path, I couldn't finish, unfortunately, but I did. So it delays a lot of things, but counseling helps for me. And I just pray, and I keep looking forward.
I get it. What do you think is the biggest misconceptions that people who don't walk in your shoes have about this condition that you wish they knew?
Well, I guess they look at you and they feel, she looks healthy. She looks fine.
Yeah.
Is it just all in her head? So is, and people think it's normal. There is normal to have painful periods, but it's not. And that's why I just kind of started, being a patient advocate more so, trying to tap into communities that maybe feel that way. But once I started having painful periods, I went to the doctor, like I said, and talked about it. But there are so many that don't really realize or know a diagnosis or ever been diagnosed. Unlike I was diagnosed. And like I said, surgeries helped for a few years, and then they didn't. And I decided to start it holistically trying to manage it.
To our listeners out there, they're going to be wondering, especially if they identify with what you're describing, what they should be doing. So I want to give you the opportunity to give them either advice or message that other women listening to the show, listening to you, may have a question that you want to tell them or you wish someone would have told you.
If you're suffering with painful periods, or not necessarily painful periods, because endometriosis is kind of, it's a disguise, but seek your doctor first. And if he doesn't act, or get a second opinion, a third opinion, take control of your own health, you know, advocate a little bit more, and try to, your loved ones, try to pull them in to kind of help them understand what your challenges are. The more we talk about it, the more we raise awareness, and it can help and hopefully pause a lot of the disparities within it.
I appreciate that. Dr. Adams, you've been listening to Tam share her story. I'm wondering how is what you're hearing from Tam, is that the typical story?
It is spot on. And I would add that the fact that she was willing to have the diagnosis made so early on, that's probably the biggest obstacle that I run into with patients when they come in, because it's not a diagnosis where I can just send you for an ultrasound or a CAT scan or something that's non-invasive. We have to actually plan surgery. And for some people, financially, it's not feasible to just up and have surgery, or to take time off of work or for the procedure itself or for the recovery just to make a diagnosis. And so sometimes they will request, was there anything that we can do to empirically diagnose it? And sometimes physicians will use birth control pills or other medications that suppress ovarian function to make an empiric diagnosis of endometriosis. But a lot of times, especially in GYN, because it seems like, well, birth control pills are your answer to everything.
Right.
Heavy cycles, take some pills. Don't want to get pregnant, take some pills, you know. And but for this specifically, the mechanism of action is the ovarian suppression that stops these endometriosis implants from being active during the cycles. And so a lot of women will come to me in their 30s and say, well, I had painful cycles before, and they just put me on pills and they got better. But they never really got the diagnosis of endometriosis. And now there's a question about fertility. And now we're backtracking, trying to make that diagnosis many years later, and then dealing with the repercussions of not knowing for many years that that's what they had.
Are people aware of endometriosis in your experience? Do people know? Certainly the people who have it are aware, but do others, the general public, are there? Is there a decent awareness of this or not?
So more and more now, which I guess we can credit social media for some of this.
Okay, you know, something positive.
Right, exactly. But when I, you know, when I started practicing 20 or so years ago, you were explaining it to people who had never heard of it. But now we have celebrities and influencers who are coming out and saying, hey, I finally got this diagnosis for something that, as Tam mentioned before, I didn't even realize was abnormal, because it is so common. Like, a lot of women do have some cramping with their cycles. But when we talk about the degree and severity, some women just feel like, well, maybe everyone is experiencing this and it's just what I have to go through. And then after they have a procedure like Tam had, they said, holy cow, I didn't realize that cycles weren't supposed to be incapacitating.
Right. In our last moment here, Dr. Adams, and I'll ask you this also, Tam, as well. What website, resource, information do you recommend people to go to if they have questions on this topic?
So I always send everyone to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. They have committee opinions out there, but there are also patient bulletins that are written in ways that are easy to understand, or at least to start conversation.
Tam, have you used same resource or any others?
I started learning a lot more about it before Dr. Adams was my doctor on social media, and I just put in endometriosis, hashtag endometriosis. You'll find a lot of stories. You'll find a lot of organizations. You'll find a lot of patient advocates that are talking, and you will start to understand what you maybe have to include into your daily life to help manage it and learn about the different surgeries, whether it's the removal of it versus the burning off of the endo lesions. And myself, I have a Instagram, Shed a Light On, where I have started spreading awareness here locally, in Jacksonville locally.
I really appreciate it. I'm going to let that be our final word. I want to thank you both, Dr. Adams, and you, Ms. Tam Carter, for joining us today, for talking about this. Is I think been very helpful. It's helped me understand it better, and hopefully our listeners as well. So I just really appreciate your time and giving and coming in studio today to talk about all of this.
Thank you for the opportunity to share.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We've been talking to Dr. Chandra Adams. She is a practicing OBGYN and an expert in endometriosis. Here in Jacksonville, she's affiliated with the HCA Memorial Hospital, and Ms. Tam Carter, who is someone who is experiencing endometriosis and bravely shared her journey with us today. Up next, we turn our attention to artificial intelligence in healthcare, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. We now change our focus to AI in healthcare, AI meaning artificial intelligence. Now, to give you a scope of AI's footprint in healthcare, it's projected to grow from $21 billion, that's with a B, to a staggering $148 billion in just the next 5 years. And it's currently being used directly in the exam room to improve the quality of patient care. So beyond just the front office where AI is used for scheduling and follow-ups, now doctors are using it through their mobile devices during their one-on-ones with patients for generation of clinical notes by having AI listen into the care visit so that AI can interpret the patient-physician conversation in real time, providing a complete summary of the visit and documenting it within 30 seconds. The good side is this allows the doctor to focus solely on their patient conversation and examination and not having to split their attention by also writing notes and commentary. Additionally, the doctor doesn't have to spend administrative hours during the day dictating or writing up notes on each patient's visit, which in turn allows that doctor or provider to schedule more patients each day. AI is helping to improve healthcare by analyzing patient medical records, images, to identify patterns that may indicate early stages of diseases, which may allow for timely intervention and treatment. It's also looking at individual and larger population or demographic health trends to identify risk factors and predict the likelihood of developing specific diseases, allowing for proactive measures as well. Dr. Robert Murray is the Chief Medical Officer of NextGen Healthcare. He currently practices family medicine, is board certified in family medicine and clinical informatics, and he's joining us now. Dr. Murray, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Dr. Servin. So thank you so much for having me.
It is so good to have you here. Let's get right into it. This is so cool. So NextGen Healthcare has is leveraging AI to improve the experience of you, especially for the administrative things for doctors, by listening in to the conversation through this ambient learning tool. Can you kind of expound a little bit about this?
Sure. And it is pretty cool. So my guess is that many people in your audience will have had the experience where they go to the doctor or a healthcare provider and the doctor spends the whole visit with, you know, their head buried in the computer.
Correct.
and as a practicing family doctor, and I can tell you, the doctor does not want to be doing that, right? The doctor would much rather pay attention to you, but they have all of this computer work and they have to document the visit. And so what's super exciting about this technology that we're bringing to the market called ambient listening is that it uses artificial intelligence and it uses the doctor's smartphone in the exam room. It listens to the natural conversation between the patient and the healthcare provider. And then at the end of the visit, in about 30 seconds, it returns a summary of that visit. It's really the start of the note of the encounter that the doctor or the healthcare provider needs to produce. Does it in the background, it does it securely, it does it privately. And it really helps the healthcare provider focus on the patient, and it gives the patient the great experience of being able to look at the doctor as opposed to the doctor looking at the computer.
How are patients reacting to this? I mean, this is being done now.
It is being done now. Yeah, I've been doing this in my practice for about a year, and we've got lots of physicians of all kinds over the country that are using this technology. And the patients in general, they love it, right? I mean, they love being able to have their doctor's full attention during the visit. And so it's a good thing. Some patients are asking questions, and of course we recommend that a brief conversation be had around the privacy aspects of this. But the way that we at NextGen Healthcare do our ambient listening, as soon as the note is returned to the doctor's computer system, everything is deleted. The conversation, the audio, the transcript, and there's never any people involved in the generation of that note. So it's really very secure and very private. And it's a good kind of AI that patients should be comfortable seeing used.
So when someone is if a patient is seeing their doctor that's using this, it does it look as like what does the doctor's cell phone is just on an app and you just doing the conversation and that's it? There's no special extra equipment or anything like that going on?
Nope, just the phone. And so I'll sit down and talk to my patient and say, hey, I'm going to use my phone and some speech recognition to help me write my note. Is that okay with you? I haven't had a single patient say no. And I just put the phone down. You don't have to look at it. I mean, you can see what it's doing. It's taking a transcript of the conversation. And people familiar with like how Siri works on the phone if you use it for text messaging. So it's turning the conversation into words. And then those words are then run through the AI routine to turn it into the note, the doctor's note.
One of the things that I always find both amusing and not amusing is like when I ask ChatGPT a question, and sometimes I've asked questions about myself into it, it has literally made up stuff about me that I'm like, this is completely false. Does the system have is that a possibility? Could this make up stuff in the clinical note?
Yeah, it's a great question. And obviously that would be a disaster if that were to happen. So yeah, a lot of people call that hallucination when the AI right. is hallucinating. But this system doesn't do that because you're not asking it to make anything up. What you're asking it to do in a little bit more detail is you're asking it to take that voice-to-text transcript of the conversation that has occurred and reformulate it in the pattern of a medical note. And the AI system has been trained with, thousands and thousands and thousands of medical notes. So it has, in its weird computer brain, it has an idea of what that is supposed to contain and look like. And so it takes the snippets of the conversation and puts it into that format, but it doesn't make up things along the way.
We often talk about issues that have to do with healthcare errors. And AI is touted as one of those solutions in terms of trying to lower the rate of errors, particularly when it comes to diagnosis and or treatment. Do we know yet how this is doing with regards to helping improve the quality of care? Have some fail safe so that we have the right patient when we're talking about a patient, or we're trying to fix errors that are very preventable. How do you foresee this, or what do we know about these type of tools in trying to help that part of healthcare?
That is really a great question, Dr. Servin. So people may not realize this, but a lot of medical error comes from miscommunication, right? And even in the exam room of an outpatient visit, right, there is lots of imperfect communication between the doctor and the patient. And, you know, I've been practicing family medicine for 20 years. I, you know, try to communicate with my patients well, but I know that there are misses there. And so one thing that I've certainly personally seen, and we've heard from other physicians and providers using this technology, is that communication actually improves. And it's ironic, right? You're using AI to help you improve the communication between the two people in the room. But here's how that works. So, you know, I obviously have been using the system. I know that when I say things out loud, that I don't have to document them later, that the system really is pretty skilled at capturing those. And so what I definitely make sure that I do is I will say even more perhaps out loud with the patient there with me than I would have before. I'll try to say very clearly, you know, this is what I think you have. This is what I don't think you have, right? These are some tests that we're gonna run, and this is what we hope to learn with the results of those tests. You know, here's the medicine that I'm gonna maybe give you. Here's what you can do to make yourself better, right? All of those things out loud around the plan. And I do that because I don't want to have to type that stuff and the AI is going to do it for you. But it really promotes, physician-patient communication, because if the patient has questions about that plan or is not able to do one of the things that I'm suggesting that they do, it's very natural to say, wait a second, you know, I don't know if I can do that, or to have a deeper conversation around that plan right there. So the AI is helping ensure that there's communication there, because I'm trying to say things clearly for it, but that ends up, of course, saying them clearly for the patient.
And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Robert Murray. He is the Chief Medical Officer of NextGen Healthcare, and we're talking about the use of AI in healthcare. One of the issues that comes up a lot, in fact, this was just written up in a recent issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association with a conversation with the editor, an expert on AI, and specifically how AI sometimes it inculcates or magnifies ethnic, racial biases and things of that sort when working with it. A tool like this, is it just going to mirror whatever's in that exam room? I guess it's a long way of asking, how does this touch on this whole issue of health equity, healthcare disparities, if you will?
That's another terrific question. So it is possible, right, that there may be some biases in the way that this system does its work, right? It translates or reframes a conversation between the provider and the patient into a medical note. Now, if I think about the broad spectrum of everything that people are trying AI for in healthcare, I think this is certainly among the lower risks of introducing that bias in there. But it is certainly true that the system has been trained on, you know, thousands of notes from a wide variety of contexts. And, you know, it's not smart. It doesn't necessarily translate everything that the patient says, you know, into the note. And it may miss some things more so for certain, you know, groups of patients or certain types of patients than others. But the system here is not making any decisions. It's not it's not calculating anything or predicting anything or telling the doctor what the diagnosis is. And so there's not very much risk of bias from that. And the way that we implement it is also encourage the physicians and the providers using it that they are going to need to add to these notes. These notes are not perfect. They're not supposed to be perfect. They're supposed to just save them time, keep them from having to type all of that, you know, simple type of information in. They will still need to add their, you know, medical thinking and decision making there. And so the physician, you know, absolutely has a chance to be on the lookout for, you know, any kind of misrepresentation or bias, so to speak, in terms of what the AI has done for its part of the job.
One of the things, Dr. Murray, that I'm curious about is I myself am listening to this, and I can't wait to get my hands on it because I see it saving me lots of trouble and time because I think this is a big help. How do you think other providers, doctors, and other folks out there, their adoption of this technology? Do you see this everyone's clamoring for it, or will this be a tough sell?
Yeah, pretty much everyone is clamoring for it.
I had a feeling.
The technology, it's astoundingly good. I mean, it's you would even a year ago or a year and a half ago, it was just nowhere nearly as good as it is now, and it wasn't ready for prime time. But, you know, even for most physicians or most healthcare providers, it is going to save them time, right? Even if it helped them write half of the notes for half of their patients, right? Would you, Dr. Servin, would you want a system that helps you do that? Oh, and most people say, yes, of course. You know, any number of minutes that you can save me, you know, allows me to get out of the office or see another patient and be more accessible. And so our almost universal reaction from the actual people that are using it has been universally positive. How soon can I get this? Don't you dare take this away from me, which is great.
That's exactly what you want to hear. There are many folks out there, they hear the word AI, and they immediately get very concerned AI replaces humans, it dehumanizes, it depersonalizes. How do you see AI working between the doctor-patient or patient-provider relationship? How do you see tools like this and other versions of AI impacting that relationship?
Well, I think like everything with AI, it really depends on the use. It depends on the scenario. So in this case, right, where the AI is helping to, you know, condense and kind of formalize the conversation that's in the exam room into a medical note, that's actually a good use of AI. It's good that the AI is a bit impersonal and tries to be, you know, very kind of factual in how it's, you know, writing that note here. And as I mentioned earlier, it's ironic, but by making it where the physician or the healthcare provider does not need to stay buried in the computer,
right,
and allowing them to really, you know, look at the patient and focus on the conversation and really, you know, have a lot more fun doing their job. It's ironic, but the AI is helping promote those kinds of personal, you know, interactions rather than the opposite. But there are, you know, a lot of other potential and even current uses of AI where it can do exactly what you're saying. It makes things less personal, and you know, hopefully over time, people realize they don't want that, and those uses of AI kind of, you know, become less frequent.
Dr. Murray, are there any regulatory challenges or barriers that you or your company has faced in deploying tools like this in healthcare? And if so, how did you get past it?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So the overall answer is no, mostly. But, you know, AI is something that the federal government, state governments, and even some local jurisdictions are very interested in regulating. Not so much ambient listening, the kind of AI that we've been talking about today, but just more AI, you know, in general, right? They do want to make sure that AI is protecting people's privacy as it's using it, as it's doing its work, and keeping things secure. The government is also very interested in health equity in AI, and there are a number of regulations that we are meeting around that regard. But as of this moment, we haven't run into any hard barriers in terms of meeting regulatory requirements or allowing this technology to really help both doctors and patients. And so from an industry standpoint, but also from a physician standpoint, I'm hopeful that the regulators do not take too heavy of a hand and allow some of the real kind of slam dunk uses of AI, such as what I think this one is, to proceed, as long as, you know, reasonable privacy, security, that sort of thing is taken into account, which we certainly feel it is in the way that we implement it.
One of the questions that also comes up from AI, and I hear this a lot from actually a lot of various folks, is that they always think of AI seems like this black box. Things go in, decisions are made, whammo, bammo, it spits this at you. And then you're like, how did it come up with that? And then what happens is, like, you know, like an open AI says, well, you know, you're not accountable, or they have to answer to it. How do you navigate that in your role, in terms of just trying to help make sure that how decisions are made in these algorithms and things that are spit out from it, that there's decent transparency and even accountability as to what comes out from it?
Well, yeah, I'm certainly familiar with what you're talking about. You're using, you know, ChatGPT or whatever, and I'm just like, what is it saying? Where did it come up with that? But again, in this kind of particular application, right, that doesn't come up very much. So it doesn't hallucinate, it doesn't make stuff up. So sometimes people are saying, well, why did it, you know, not capture this part of the conversation, right? Yeah. You know, I know as a doctor that part of the conversation was really important. And my answer back to them, or you know, the what we try to train them, is that, you know, the system isn't smart. Like, it doesn't know what's important, right? And the more closely you can say out loud the conversation with the patient in a way that the computer is going to be able to easily match to something that it's learned is typically in a medical note, then the more likely is that it's going to be included. And so folks adjust to that quite rapidly, because they don't want to have to do a lot of, you know, editing of the note or supplementing of the note afterwards. And as I said, that can actually be a very good thing, because it can promote better in the room conversation with the patient, particularly around the plan, like, what is it that the doctor thinks is going on, and what is their mutual plan to you know, try to make the patient feel better.
Dr. Murray, in our last moments here, as you look to the future, and you take out that crystal ball, and since you're very involved in these electronic medical records and other aspects of what NextGen does, what role do you see AI playing in the evolution of healthcare? What are we not talking about that's likely to come up?
Well, what I'm most hopeful is that this kind of AI, where it is helping the people do all of the work that needs to be done in healthcare, that is really what the future looks like, right? There's a very famous survey, it's only a couple of years old, in the Journal of Internal Medicine, that says a typical adult primary care provider would have to spend 27 and a half hours a day delivering all of the needed preventive care for their patients. And obviously that's impossible, right? There's too much work for all of the people in medicine to do it perfectly all the time. And so what I'm very helpful is that, you know, this system and others like it are going to take away that tedious, time-consuming work from the healthcare providers and make them better able to serve patients more efficiently, more rewardingly, and that patients benefit from the attention and the concentration that their healthcare providers are able to give them, because some of the trivial work is done automatically by AI in the background.
Dr. Murray, I want to thank you so much for joining us. This is fascinating. I think that you've put many a smile on many a provider's face, and to our patients, that's a good thing. So I just want to thank you so much for giving us your time today and telling us about these cool things that are happening.
You're very welcome, Dr. Servin. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Dr. Robert Murray. He is the Chief Medical Officer of NextGen Healthcare, and he's been talking to us about AI in healthcare and a specific form of it, ambient listening, where AI is helping to derive the clinical note to save everyone time. Well, that's our program for today. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Lutkin. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Brady Corum is our director. Kathy Waterman is our associate producer. Next week's program is a special show spotlighting colorectal cancer with Channel 4's Bruce Hamilton, and famed vaccine expert Paul Offit tells us about his new book. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tag me on X at Jay Servin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jackson. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. The American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And ReThreaded restores choice and breaks the cycle of generational trauma for survivors of human trafficking in Jacksonville, Florida, through business. You can help. Learn more about ReThreaded survivor-created goods at the storefront or ReThreaded.com/shop.